building, Bob Mueller entered the room. He leaned down and spoke to Ashcroft in intensely personal terms, terms that would surprise those who knew the stoic Mueller well. "In every man's life there comes a time when the good Lord tests him," he told Ashcroft. "You passed your test tonight." Ashcroft did not reply. As Mueller wrote in his notes that night, he found the Attorney General feeble, barely articulate, clearly stressed. "The moment had taken a toll on me. My heart was racing. I was feeling slightly dizzy. But when I heard Bob Mueller's tender words, I felt like crying. The law had held. But neither Gonzalez nor Card were finished with me yet. An agent summoned me to the temporary command center the FBI had set up in the next room. Card was on the phone, and the president's chief of staff, still reeling from his experience with Ashcroft, was pissed. He instructed me to come see him at the White House immediately. I was so offended by the effort to manipulate a sick, possibly dying man to subvert the law that I couldn't hold back any longer. After the conduct I just witnessed, I told Card, I will not meet with you without a witness. He got hotter. What conduct? He protested. We were just there to wish him well. That lie was poison, but I wasn't going to rise to it. I said again, slowly and calmly, after the conduct I just witnessed, I will not meet with you without a witness. And then I added, because it had just occurred to me, and I intend that witness to be the Solicitor General of the United States. Are you refusing to come to the White House? Card asked, clearly taken aback. No, sir. I will come as soon as I am able to reach the Solicitor General to come with me. The call ended. I thought of Ted Olson, the Solicitor General, for the same reason I earlier thought of Bob Mueller. As with Bob, Ted and I weren't friends, but I liked him and respected him. More important, so did the President and the Vice President. I needed his stature, his weight with them. I also had no doubt he would see the legal issues as we did if the Vice President would let him in the circle. I reached out to Olson, who was also out at dinner. He agreed to meet me right away at the Justice Department and to accompany me to the White House. Just after 11 p.m., as a light rain began to fall, the Solicitor General and I rode together in the U.S. Marshal's armored car to the White House. We walked up the carpeted stairs to Card's West Wing office, just steps from the Oval Office, where Card met us outside his door, asking Ted Olson to wait outside while he spoke with me. Card seemed calmer, so my instincts told me not to fight to have Olson in the room. Once we were alone, Card began by expressing his hope that people would calm down. He said he had heard talk about resignations. I learned later that Jack Goldsmith had asked his deputy, who like most others was not read into the program, to prepare a letter of resignation for him. The deputy alerted a friend at the White House, who apparently had informed Card. The chief of staff could see catastrophe coming in the form of disastrous headlines and an election year political scandal. I don't think people should ever resign to get their way, I replied. Instead, I said, they should work hard to get something right on the merits. If they can't get there, and the issue is important enough, then they should quit. The door to Card's office opened. Gonzalez walked in. He had seen Olson sitting outside and invited him into Card's office as well. The four of us sat and quietly reviewed the state of play. We reached no agreement, and they did not explain what they had been doing at Ashcroft's bedside, but the emotional temperature had dropped. We adjourned. Years later, I had the chance to hear how my staff experienced that night, when so many of them knew something bad was happening and raced to the hospital, but didn't know what was actually going on. Chuck Rosenberg, my chief of staff, walked the streets around the hospital but couldn't find his car. He had jumped out of it and run to the hospital to be with me. In his haste, he forgot to mark where he had parked. He took a cab home to Virginia at 2:30 a.m. Rosenberg didn't drink alcohol, so his wife was mystified by his inability to find his car. The mystery was only deepened by his explanation that, someday I may be able to tell you. It was years before she would know the story. Fortunately, he found the family car at first light the next day. Deputy Chief of Staff Dawn Burton's story is my favorite. Around 7 p.m., with the boss gone for the night, she had been checking in with other staff members on the fourth floor hall, trying to recruit a group to go have drinks. After being repeatedly told everyone was too busy, she retreated to her office to continue her own work. Short time later, a colleague burst into her office and said, "Grab your coat and meet us in the garage." "Yes!" she shouted, and hurried to the garage. There, she was bustled into the backseat of a car packed with staff for a harrowing but silent drive to George Washington University Hospital. She ended up pacing with colleagues in the hall down from Ashcroft's room with no idea why they were there. She made a last pitch for drinks as the group filed out of the hospital, but nobody had fun that night. When I finally arrived home in the early morning hours of Thursday, March 11th, the house was dark and quiet. Patrice and the five kids were long asleep. For days, Patrice knew I was struggling with a very hard problem, involving major conflict with the White House. I couldn't talk to her because any communication about classified topics requires that both parties have the appropriate clearance and a work-related need to know the information. She didn't have either. That separation from my family and closest friend added to my stress, as it does to many couples involved in classified work. I was sleeping little and deeply troubled, although she didn't know what it was about. I went into the kitchen to grab a snack. Patrice had printed out an excerpt from my Senate confirmation hearing less than 6 months earlier. As she and the kids sat behind me that day, senators had pressed me on how, as Deputy Attorney General, I would handle conflict with the White House. The context for their questions was how I would handle politically controversial investigations, but she had taped part of my answer to the refrigerator door. I don't care about politics. I don't care about expediency. I don't care about friendship. I care about doing the right thing, and I would never be part of something that I believe to be fundamentally wrong. I mean, obviously we all make policy judgments where people disagree, but I will do the right thing. I awoke a few hours later to news that terrorists had attacked commuter trains in Madrid during the night. The day was consumed by those terrible attacks, and our effort, in conjunction with the CIA and other intelligence agencies, to find out whether there were serious threats of similar plots in our own country. We met early at FBI headquarters, and then Director Mueller and I drove to the Oval Office threat briefing. We met with the President, the Vice President, and their senior team. There was no mention of Stellar Wind. After the briefing, I stopped Fran Townsend in the hallway. I had known Fran since our days as prosecutors in New York. She was now serving as National Security Advisor Condi Rice's deputy. Rice had not been at the Tuesday meeting with the Vice President. Was it possible the National Security Advisor wasn't read into the Stellar Wind program? If she were read in now, I wondered, might she be a voice of reason? I told Townsend that I wanted to say a term to her, and I needed to know if her boss recognized the term. Fran looked confused, but I pressed on. "Stellar Wind," I said. "I need to know if she knows that term." She said she would find out. Later that day, Townsend called me to say that her boss knew that term, was fully up to speed, and had nothing to add. I would get no help from Rice. Back at Justice, Goldsmith and Philbin confirmed that the White House had gone silent on Stellar Wind. We waited. Late that afternoon, the two came to see me. The President had reauthorized the program despite our warnings. The new order had some significant differences. The line for the Attorney General's signature had been removed and replaced with a line for White House Counsel Al Gonzalez. Addington also added language to authorize NSA activity that had not been covered by his earlier drafts of the President's orders. We were done here. I knew this would be my final night in government service. The same for Bob Mueller. Like me, he could not continue to serve in an administration that was going to direct the FBI to participate in activity that had no lawful basis. I drafted a resignation letter and went home and told Patrice I was quitting the next day. Again, I had to leave out the particulars of why. Friday, March 12, was a somber morning. I was up and gone before breakfast, so I didn't hear Patrice tell the kids, "Daddy may be getting a new job, but it's all going to be fine." Bob Mueller and I went through the motions at our usual early morning terrorism threat session at FBI headquarters, then we drove together to the White House for the regular Oval Office threat briefing. We both stood silently looking out the window at the Rose Garden as we waited for the door by the grandfather clock to open so we could join the President's morning briefing. I was trying to memorize a view I would never see again. The door opened. The meeting felt surreal. We talked about Madrid and Al-Qaeda and everything other than the collision that was threatened to topple the administration. Then we got up and headed for the door. Mueller was ahead of me. I was just rounding the end of the couch, steps from the door, when I heard the President's voice. "Jim," the President said, "can I talk to you for a minute?" I turned back and President Bush led me across the Oval Office, down a short hall, and into the president's private dining room. We sat at a table with one chair on each of four sides. The president sat with his back to the windows, and I took the chair nearest the door. "You don't look well," the president began, adding with typical bluntness, "We don't need anybody else dropping." One of my colleagues from another agency had fainted when leaving the West Wing a day or so earlier. "I haven't been sleeping much," I confessed. "I feel a tremendous burden." "Let me lift that burden from your shoulders," the president said. "I wish you could, Mr. President, but you can't. I feel like I'm standing in the middle of railroad tracks. A train is coming that is going to run over me and my career, but I can't get off the tracks." "Why?" "Because we simply can't find a reasonable argument to support parts of the Stellar Wind program." We then discussed the details of the program and the problematic parts. I finished by saying, "We just can't certify to its legality." "But I say what the law is for the executive branch," he replied. "You do, sir. But only I can say what the Justice Department can certify as lawful. And we can't here. We have done our best. But as Martin Luther said, here I stand, I can do no other." "I just wish you hadn't sprung these objections on us at the last minute." I was shocked. "If that's what you were told, Mr. President, you've been badly misled by your staff. We have been telling them about this for weeks." He paused as if digesting that revelation. "Can you just give me until May 6th so I can try to get a legislative fix? This program is really important. If I can't get it, I will shut it down." "We can't do that, Mr. President, and we've been saying that for weeks." I paused, took a breath, and then overstepped my role as a lawyer to offer policy advice to the president. "And Mr. President, I feel like I should say something else. The American people are going to freak when they find out what we have been doing." He seemed irritated for the first time. "Let me worry about that," he said sharply. "Yes, sir, but I thought it had to be said." He paused, and I knew our conversation was coming to an end. As I had told his chief of staff Wednesday night, I didn't believe in threatening resignation to win an argument. I thought the argument should be fought on the merits, and then people could decide whether to quit after the decision. It always felt like cheating to say you would take your ball and go home if you didn't get your way. Still, I wanted to find a way to help Bush. This man, whom I liked and wanted to see succeed, appeared not to realize the storm that was coming. The entire Justice Department leadership was going to quit, and just as he was running for re-election. An uprising of that sort hadn't even happened during the worst days of Watergate. I had to tell him, to warn him. But I didn't want to break my rule, so I clumsily tried another approach. "You should know that Bob Mueller is going to resign this morning," I said. He paused again. "Thank you for telling me that." He extended his hand and showed me back to and across the Oval Office. I walked out past the clock and went immediately downstairs where Bob Mueller stood waiting for me in the West Wing lower level. I had just started to describe my conversation with the president when a Secret Service agent approached to say the president wanted to see Mueller upstairs immediately. Bob came down about 10 minutes later. We went out to his armored Suburban and climbed in the back. He asked his driver to step out. The driver later told me he knew something was up because it was the first time in a decade of driving that he had been asked to step out. He told me he and the president had covered much of the same ground. Bob confirmed to him that he could not stay as director under these circumstances and implored the president to listen to us. The president replied with a directive. "Tell Jim to do what needs to be done to get this to a place where justice is comfortable." That was all we needed, an order from the president. That took us around the vice president, Card, and Gonzalez, and even around Addington and his safe full of secret orders. We headed back to the Justice Department where we briefed our senior staff. Our first task was to get more good lawyers read in. Ted Olson was preparing for a Supreme Court argument, so his deputy, Paul Clement, was added to the team, as were more of those brilliant monks from the Office of Legal Counsel. CIA and NSA lawyers joined the team. Addington couldn't stop us from making the circle bigger. The team worked all weekend to shape a new draft presidential order that narrowed the scope of the NSA's authority. I decided to send a classified memo to the White House summarizing the problems and our recommended fixes. That would make it a presidential record forever, an answer in a formal way the president's direction to Mueller. This memo documented what needed to be done for justice to be comfortable. It was a bit of a jerk move, because it created a permanent and complete record of all the ways they had been out of bounds. But the time to be a bit of a jerk was now. Goldsmith and Philbin hand-delivered a copy of the memo to Gonzalez at home late Sunday night. It really pissed off some people at the White House. On Tuesday, Gonzalez called me to say a memo would be coming back to us from the White House. He asked me not to overreact and said the White House was committed to working with us. I don't know whether I overreacted, but I sure reacted, and very strongly. The memo was a big middle finger, clearly written by Addington. It said we were wrong about everything and acting inappropriately by usurping presidential authority. It rejected all our proposed changes, saying they were unnecessary legally and factually. It said nothing about our mothers being whores, but it might as well have. I pulled out my resignation letter and changed the date to March 16th. Screw these people. They had just gone back on the president's directive to Bob Mueller and were leaving in place an unlawful order. I told Ashcroft's chief of staff that I was resigning again. He asked me to wait. He was sure Ashcroft would want to quit with the rest of us, but he was still too ill. Could we give him a few days to get stronger? Of course. I put the letter back in my drawer. 2 days later, without notice, the president signed a new order. It incorporated all the changes we had requested, all the changes that the middle finger letter said were unnecessary. The order said the president was making these changes for operational reasons, not because we said he had to or because our interpretation of the law required it. That was childish, but we really didn't care. With that order, the program was now in a place where the Office of Legal Counsel could articulate reasonable arguments to support it, and they did, in a memo Goldsmith and Philbin and the new team members completed in early May. The Stellar Wind crisis was over. Now things would get really tough.
Chapter 7. Confirmation Bias. It ain't what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. Mark Twain. In April 2004, while Jack Goldsmith and his team at Justice were still trying to put the NSA surveillance program on firmer legal footing, sickening images of prisoner mistreatment at Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention facility in Iraq, became public. The pictures showed a small number of American service members mistreating Iraqi prisoners in horrific ways. Iraqi detainees were put in humiliating positions. Some pictures showed prisoners hooded and disrobed. One of the more memorable had unclothed human beings stacked on top of each other in a naked pyramid. There were images of angry dogs being sicked on handcuffed prisoners, and others of vulnerable detainees being mocked and laughed at by American soldiers. Very quickly, a single word surfaced in the coverage to describe these acts: torture. Coming 6 or 7 months before a competitive presidential election, the images took a devastating toll on the Bush administration. In nationally televised testimony before Congress, the Secretary of Defense offered public apologies to the detainees and their families, and promised a thorough investigation into wrongdoing. The Secretary of State compared the Abu Ghraib abuses to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, an event that helped turn public opinion against the war. And there were more revelations still to come. With the entire civilized world condemning the images of torture by the United States government, the CIA, understandably, became very nervous about a clandestine program of its own, under which the agency had beaten, starved, humiliated, and nearly drowned captives in 2002 and 2003. These were people the CIA believed had information about terrorist plots against the United States, and who were being held at so-called black sites outside of U.S. territory. At the start, in the summer of 2002, the CIA turned to the Department of Justice to determine the limits of what it could do legally while interrogating these suspected terrorists in their custody. In June 2004, 2 months after the Abu Ghraib photos surfaced, Jack Goldsmith came to me to explain his findings on the interrogation program. He had spotted serious problems 6 months earlier and told the intelligence agencies they could not rely on the earlier legal work. But now, with Stellar Wind fixed, he had completed his analysis and knew the Justice Department's opinions could not stand. As with the Stellar Wind program, he found that the earlier legal work supporting the interrogation program was deeply flawed. And as in Stellar Wind, he believed the agency was going beyond even what the flawed opinions allowed. This was another mess, one that following Abu Ghraib found itself all over the media after someone leaked a classified draft of Department of Justice guidance on torture, and it led to another battle within the Bush administration between a secret policy agenda and the rule of law. In 1994, Congress had decided as a legal matter to define torture differently from how most of us understand the term. In ratifying the United Nations Convention Against Torture, Congress defined torture for American law as the intentional infliction of severe mental or physical pain or suffering. There is a whole lot that most of us would call torture that falls short of severe pain or severe suffering. Most of us would think that confining someone in a dark coffin-like box or chaining them naked to the ceiling for days without sleep is torture. But the way Congress chose to define it, by requiring that the pain and suffering be severe, a judge or lawyer could conclude those actions do not meet the legal definition of torture. In 2002, after the 9/11 attacks, the CIA wanted to use coercive physical tactics to get captured al-Qaeda leaders to turn on other terrorist leaders, reveal plots, and hopefully save innocent lives. Agency officials asked the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel whether the interrogation tactics they had in mind, such as cramped confinement, sleep deprivation, and simulated drowning called waterboarding, would violate the law against torture. To be clear, they didn't ask Justice Department lawyers, "Is this a good idea?" They only asked them to outline what the boundaries of the law were. As with the Stellar Wind program, the Justice Department was asked to make these decisions during a time of crisis, when leaders feared more 9/11-style attacks were coming. The Justice Department lawyers were assured by CIA officials and others in the Bush administration that physically abusive interrogations of captured al-Qaeda leaders were not only effective, but essential to saving countless innocent lives. Under that kind of pressure, and working almost entirely alone, a Justice Department lawyer, the same one who did the flawed Stellar Wind legal work, prepared a legal opinion interpreting the torture statute very broadly. He also issued a separate opinion saying the tactics the CIA had in mind for its first captured subject, Abu Zubaydah, did not constitute torture under the law. The CIA was cleared to use the full menu of tactics on Zubaydah, from slapping him and keeping him awake to making him think he was dying during waterboarding. By late 2003, when Jack Goldsmith became head of the Office of Legal Counsel and I became Deputy Attorney General, the CIA had already relied on that legal advice to aggressively interrogate suspects at various black sites outside the United States. I wasn't looking forward to another ugly, draining fight against the same powerful faction in the White House. The fight over the surveillance program had been a stressful time, not just for me, but also for my family. I thought I was going to lose my job. Patrice and I had a floating, interest-only mortgage on our home, and we were not in a good place financially as parents of five kids fast approaching college age. As the United States Attorney in Manhattan and as the number two person in the Justice Department, and later as FBI director, I made about what a first-year lawyer at a New York law firm was paid. Of course, plenty of people raise kids on that salary. We just hadn't planned well. But I agreed with Goldsmith that the legal opinion about torture was just wrong. So I went to Attorney General Ashcroft and in a private meeting told him why I believed it made sense to take the dramatic step of withdrawing the Justice Department's earlier opinion on the legality of these actions. He agreed. We both recognized that it would leave CIA personnel exposed, in a sense, because they had done some rough stuff in reliance on a legal opinion that was now withdrawn. The interrogators weren't lawyers. They had a right to rely on the advice of government counsel. But they had acted based on bad advice from the Justice Department, and that shouldn't continue. A new legal opinion had to be written that was legally sound and firmly grounded in the facts. Though it was not our role to judge the program's value to the country, Goldsmith and I were both familiar with the world of FBI interrogations. The Bureau had long ago concluded that coercive interrogations were of no utility, the information obtained largely useless or unreliable. Instead, over decades, the FBI had perfected the art of rapport-building interrogation, forming a trusting relationship with those in its custody. The FBI had succeeded time after time in getting life-saving and timely information from terrorists, mobsters, and serial killers. As a result, we were deeply skeptical of what we were told about the effectiveness of the CIA's coercive tactics. It struck me as the kind of stuff pushed by chicken hawks, aggressive-sounding administration officials who had seen plenty of movies but had never actually been in the storm. The CIA leadership and the powerful administration officials who backed them up, like Vice President Dick Cheney, held a starkly different view. They were driven by one of the most powerful and disconcerting forces in human nature, confirmation bias. Our brains have evolved to crave information consistent with what we already believe. We seek out and focus on facts and arguments that support our beliefs. More worrisome, when we are trapped in confirmation bias, we may not consciously perceive facts that challenge us, that are inconsistent with what we have already concluded. In a complicated, changing, and integrated world, our confirmation bias makes us very difficult people. We simply can't change our minds. But there was more to it than biology. The president, the vice president, and those around them also labored under our political culture, where uncertainty is intolerable, where doubt is derided as weakness. Then and now, leaders feel a special pressure to be certain, a pressure that reinforces their natural confirmation bias. Of course, in a healthy organization, doubt is not weakness. It is wisdom. Because people are at their most dangerous when they are certain that their cause is just and their facts are right. And I'm not talking about finger in the wind, I'm afraid to make a decision kind of doubt. Decisions have to be made, often quickly, even the hardest decisions. And the hardest ones always seem to need to be made the fastest and on the least information. But those decisions must be made with a recognition that they could be wrong. That humility leaves the leader open to better information until the last possible moment. In fairness to the president and vice president, our modern culture makes this incredibly hard for leaders, especially those in government, even if they possess enough confidence to be humble. Admitting doubt or mistakes is career suicide. And that's the way we want it, right? We want strong, certain leaders. Imagine supporting a leader who, as he finished his time at the helm, told us that although he didn't do anything intentionally wrong, he is sure he made many mistakes, prays his mistakes haven't hurt people, and hopes we will forgive and forget the times when he was incompetent. That weakling would be run out of town on a rail. But America's first president said exactly that in his farewell to the country in 1796. Though, in reviewing the incidents of my administration, I am unconscious of intentional error, I am nevertheless too sensible of my defects not to think it probable that I may have committed many errors. Whatever they may be, I fervently beseech the Almighty to avert or mitigate the evils to which they may tend. I shall also carry with me the hope that my country will never cease to view them with indulgence, and that, after 45 years of my life dedicated to its service with an upright zeal, the faults of incompetent abilities will be consigned to oblivion, as myself must soon be to the mansions of rest. In the Bush administration, Dick Cheney, David Addington, and others had decided that enhanced interrogations, acts that fit any normal person's definition of torture, worked. They simply couldn't admit that evidence contradicting their conclusion was valid, maybe most of all to themselves. And so, in their view, people standing in the way of allowing these activities, lawyers like me, were needlessly putting lives at risk. I understood why people like Vice President Cheney were frustrated when the Department of Justice changed its legal opinions. But much of the responsibility for the original flawed legal work could be laid at the feet of policymakers like the Vice President, powerful leaders who were absolutely certain what needed to be done and who demanded quick answers from a tiny group of lawyers. Their actions guaranteed the very problems we were forced to deal with down the road. From my perspective, it was simple. The United States Department of Justice had made serious legal mistakes in advising the president and his administration about surveillance and interrogation. If the institution was to continue to be useful to the country and its presidents, including President Bush, the department simply had to fix its errors. To do otherwise, even in the face of angry leaders, would mean the Justice Department had become just another member of the partisan tribe, willing to say what needed to be said in order to help our side win. It makes good sense that the leaders of the Department of Justice are appointed by the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate. The department has important discretion on policy questions, like what kinds of crimes to prioritize, or how to approach antitrust disputes, and should be responsive in its policy choices to the will of the people, expressed through the election of the president. But there is a tension in having political leaders atop the Justice Department, because the administration of justice must be even-handed. The Constitution and the rule of law are not partisan political tools. Lady Justice wears a blindfold. She is not supposed to peek out to see how her political master wishes her to weigh a matter. There's a place I have visited on the coast of North Carolina where two barrier islands come close together. In the narrow passageway between them, the waters of the Atlantic Ocean meet the waters of the huge and shallow sound that lies behind the islands. There's turbulence in that place, and waves appear to break even though no land is visible. I imagine that the leaders of the Department of Justice stand at that spot, between the turbulent waters of the political world and the placid waters of the apolitical sound. Their job is to respond to the political imperatives of the president and the voters who elected him, while also protecting the apolitical work of the thousands of agents, prosecutors, and staff who make up the bulk of the institution. So long as the leaders understand the turbulence, they can find their footing. If they stumble, the ocean water overruns the sound, and the department has become just another political organ. Its independent role in American life has been lost, and the guardians of justice have drowned. One evening after work in spring 2004, Patrice looked at me. She obviously knew I was involved in something that was wearing me down. She had seen all the media coverage of the treatment of captives. She simply said to me, "Torture is wrong. Don't be the torture guy." "What?" I protested. "You know I can't talk about that stuff." "I don't want to talk about it," she said. "Just don't be the torture guy." She would periodically repeat that admonition over the next year. The prospect of being the torture guy disturbed my sleep for many nights. I couldn't get away from the mental pictures of naked men chained to the ceiling in a cold, blazingly lit cell for endless days, defecating in their diapers, unchained only to be further abused and convinced they were drowning before being rechained. In June 2004, Goldsmith, with my support, formally withdrew the Department of Justice legal opinions that had supported the 2002 and 2003 interrogations. True to form, the Vice President's counsel, David Addington, was furious. At a meeting I didn't attend, he pulled out a card he said listed all the classified opinions Justice had written since 9/11, and sarcastically asked Goldsmith to tell him which ones Justice still stood by. I reminded Goldsmith that Addington's anger was an increasingly reliable indicator that we were on the right track. I don't think my assessment made Jack feel any better. Nor did Patrick Philbin take any comfort in the thought. Addington spoke to Philbin privately and told him that, based on the withdrawal of the Stellar Wind and torture legal opinions, Addington believed Philbin had violated his oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. He suggested that Philbin resign and vowed that he personally would prevent him from being promoted anywhere else in the government. Jack Goldsmith was a step ahead of him. After 9 months as head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack's cherubic glow was gone. He had been through brutal battles over electronic surveillance and interrogation. At the same moment as he withdrew the torture opinion, he announced he was leaving to return to academia. Reworking the interrogation advice would fall to Dan Levin, the new acting head of the Office of Legal Counsel. Levin was another gifted and careful lawyer, with a somber look that masked a dark sense of humor. There was nothing cherubic about Levin. In an earlier role supporting Bob Mueller at the FBI, where Mueller was called the director, Levin, with his gloomy countenance, was privately referred to as the funeral director. Levin threw himself into the huge job of reworking the legal guidance supporting so-called enhanced interrogations. I didn't know it at the time, but he quite literally threw himself into it, undergoing the simulated drowning technique known as waterboarding. He later told me it was the worst experience of his life. In late December 2004, Levin and the Office of Legal Counsel finally finished the interrogation opinion. It was an impressive piece of scholarship. Careful, thoughtful, tethered tightly to the CIA's statements about how things actually worked. It did something significant that was overlooked by most people who read the lengthy unclassified opinion. Levin concluded that intentionally inflicting severe mental suffering was a separate category of prohibited conduct under the law against torture. This was a big deal. The original 2002 justice opinions had focused largely on defining severe physical pain. Suddenly it was obvious, to me and Levin at least, that the accumulation of CIA techniques could quickly become illegal because mental suffering was a broad category. Taking a naked, cold, severely sleep-deprived and calorie-deprived person, slamming him against a wall, putting him in stress positions, slapping him around, waterboarding him, and then sticking him in a small box could easily produce great mental suffering, especially if the CIA did those things more than once. There were two additional opinions that needed to follow Levin's general opinion. First, each of the CIA's techniques needed to be evaluated individually under the standards Levin had announced. That would be fairly straightforward, because a single technique, viewed in isolation, was unlikely to cause severe physical pain or severe mental suffering. The second opinion would be the whole ballgame. In that one, the CIA and White House wanted to apply Levin's standards to the combined effects of all the techniques. They needed this because nobody was interrogated using just one technique. At actual black sites, they did a whole lot of brutal stuff to their subjects. Those actions could add up very quickly to the prohibited mental suffering. It was going to be difficult to sustain the program once justice was asked to evaluate combined effects. Levin worked long hours trying to document exactly what was going on at these black site interrogations. To support the 2002 legal opinion, the interrogations had been presented to the Department of Justice as if they were highly regulated and conducted in almost surgical clinical environments. Although Levin had moved heaven and earth in 2004 to nail down exactly what was going on, it was still like nailing jello to the wall. He got it up there, but it sure looked shaky. I never asked Dan Levin this, but I suspect he shared my hope that the entire CIA interrogation program would crater under the weight of these requirements. But this, of course, was not what we were asked to do. Justice Department lawyers were only being asked to provide legal opinions based on factual representations from the CIA. Although our internal voices screamed that this was terrible stuff and was based on inflated claims of success, those voices had to stay trapped inside us. But I heard one voice many times. "Don't be the torture guy," it said. After George W. Bush won re-election in 2004, John Ashcroft had gone through the motions, like all cabinet officers, of tendering his resignation letter to the president. The tradition allowed the president flexibility to change his administration for a new term. But the hope was that cabinet officers who performed well would be asked to stay. To Ashcroft's surprise, the president accepted his resignation. To add to the sting, Bush gave Ashcroft just a few hours' notice before publicly announcing his successor. The person he had in mind as a replacement was another slap at all of us at Justice. On November 10, 2004, President Bush announced that his pick to be the next Attorney General of the United States was Alberto Gonzalez. "I was getting a new boss who had actively opposed what I viewed as the department's responsibility to enforce the law as it was written, not as the administration wanted it to be. One who seemed to prefer satisfying his boss more than focusing on hard truths. I don't know why Bush picked Gonzalez, but I suspect it was the age-old presidential mistake I would try years later to warn Donald Trump about. Because problems often come from justice, some presidents think they will benefit from a close relationship with the Attorney General. It almost always makes things worse." Later that day, I was home for Patrice's birthday when my cell phone rang. To my surprise, Gonzalez was on the line. He said he was calling to tell me he really looked forward to working with me and hoped I would stay because he would need the help. I congratulated him on his appointment and said I look forward to working with him. It seemed like the right thing to say, and I had nothing against Gonzalez personally, despite the challenges we had been through. If he was going to be Attorney General, I wanted to help him succeed. My main concern was not that he was evil, but that he was weak and would easily be overmatched by Addington and Cheney and their view that the war on terrorism justified stretching, if not breaking, the written law. I found out later that President Bush called Gonzalez immediately after the announcement and suggested that he call me. I didn't realize it at the time, but after what I knew and had not talked about from the Ashcroft hospital scene, I was something of a loaded gun in the Bush administration's eyes, one that could go off at any moment. Because I was a loaded weapon, they handled me with care, but it was obvious to me that serving as Gonzalez's deputy was not the right thing for me. In the spring of 2005, I announced I would be leaving that August. We had a new attorney general who needed his own deputy, I reasoned. I was tired and disappointed with the choice of my new boss. Without the support of Ashcroft, I didn't have the stomach for what were certain to be more losing battles within the administration. More important, my financial situation had not improved, and our oldest was headed to college. It was time to leave. I sent the president my resignation letter, making it effective in August to ensure a responsible transition. Just as I was preparing to leave the Department of Justice, Vice President Cheney began leaning on Gonzalez to produce the two remaining opinions he needed on interrogation policies. In addition to a new attorney general, the Justice Department also had a new acting leader of the Office of Legal Counsel, a bright and affable lawyer named Stephen Bradbury. Steve, who had no background in national security matters, wanted to be formally nominated for the job, and he was being pushed to produce the two opinions the way Cheney's tribe wanted. Patrick Philbin and I were disappointed to see that his opinions were overbroad, untethered to an actual case, and to our minds, deeply irresponsible. We had suggested Bradbury consider the actual recent case of someone who had been interrogated by the CIA. We knew of a terrorist who had recently been in CIA custody and whose interrogation was finished. We suggested he describe precisely what had been done to that captive and then offer an opinion as to whether that actual real-world combination of actions crossed the legal threshold. That was the only way to responsibly give an opinion. And as it happened, this actual case was one where, given what we understood had been done to that guy, we did not think it would add up to severe pain or suffering, as the statute defined it and the Department of Justice interpreted that statute, even though anyone in their right mind would say the man had been tortured. But even though the opinion would likely approve what had been done to that prisoner, that wasn't what the vice president wanted. He wanted Bradbury to rule on the legality of a hypothetical scenario, a typical interrogation, not what the CIA actually was doing to a real human being. I met with Attorney General Gonzalez to explain why I thought it was so irresponsible to write a hypothetical opinion that way, and immediately saw the difference between the Attorney General I knew and respected, John Ashcroft, and his replacement. Wearily, Gonzalez complained that the vice president was putting enormous pressure on him and that Cheney had even prompted the president to ask when the opinions would be ready. I said I understood the pressure, but there were no prototypical interrogations. They all involved real interrogators reacting to real subjects, slapping them, chilling them, cramping them, and on in permutations and combinations that were all unique. It was impossible to write a forward-looking opinion without making it look like justice was writing a blank check. Someday when this all came out, I warned him, it would look like the Attorney General had just caved in response to White House pressure and done something we would all deeply regret. If one thing motivates people in Washington, it's being on the receiving end of bad headlines. And on that thought, Gonzalez paused. It wasn't clear to me that this had ever occurred to him. I agree with you, Jim, he said. He instructed me to work with Bradbury to try and fix the approach. My relief proved short-lived. The next evening, I spoke by telephone with Gonzalez's chief of staff. He told me the interrogation opinions were to be formalized and sent the next day. There was no more time. I reminded him that the Attorney General had told me the opposite only the day before. His chief of staff told me things had changed. Bradbury finalized and signed both opinions, as he and the White House wanted it. A week after that, the White House began the background check process to formally nominate him as Assistant Attorney General. The legal battle was over. Now that we were no longer acting as lawyers on the torture question, I felt free to do what I hadn't done before. I went to the Attorney General to seek permission to request a policy review of the entire program by the National Security Council. Typically, this would lead to a full review by what is called the NSC's Deputies Committee, of which I was a member, along with the deputies of the other relevant departments and agencies in the Bush administration. The deputies would frequently hash out policy issues and tough questions before their bosses grasped the issues personally. I knew I could make my case in that setting. We would have an honest administration-wide discussion of whether we should be doing this stuff to human beings. Unfortunately, I never got that chance. The next thing I knew, strangely, the policy discussion on torture was elevated from the Deputies Committee to the Principals Committee, comprised only of the top leadership of the major defense and intelligence agencies, such as the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, CIA Director, and Attorney General. That meant that my team and I would have to prepare Gonzalez to voice our concerns for us, because nobody else from Justice was allowed to go with him. Oh boy. As Pat Philbin and I sat down to prepare Gonzalez for the May 31, 2005 White House policy discussion, the Attorney General began by showing us the writing on the wall. He said Condi Rice, who had been National Security Advisor when the interrogation program was conceived, and was now the Secretary of State, replacing Colin Powell, was not interested in discussing the details. He added that Rice believed, "If Justice says it's legal, and CIA says it's effective, that ends it. There's no need for a detailed policy discussion." Knowing I'd never be able to plead the case to others on the National Security Council, Philbin and I did our best to buck up Gonzalez to make the case on the department's behalf. We protested that just because something was deemed to be legal, based on an opinion we disagreed with, and allegedly effective did not mean it was appropriate. I again reminded him, and hoped he would remind the others in the cabinet, that someday the interrogation methods used, and the shaky legal support for them, would all become public, adding that I had heard there was a videotape of one of these CIA interrogations, and this would reflect very poorly on the president and the country. Then I showed Gonzalez a heavy stock, cream-colored 3x5 card I'd compiled. On it, I had written a list of the things that could be done to another human being under the CIA program as currently written and authorized by the Gonzalez Justice Department. Reading from the card, I painted a picture for him of a human being standing naked for days in a cold room, with hands chained overhead to the ceiling, defecating and urinating in his diaper, engulfed in deafening heavy metal music, and spending hours under a constant bright light. He's then unchained to be slapped in the face and abdomen, slammed against a wall, sprayed with cold water, and then, even though weak from a severely reduced calorie liquid diet, made to stand and squat in positions that put extreme stress on his muscles and tendons. When he can't move any longer, he will be put in a coffin-sized box for hours before being returned to the ceiling chain. And of course, in special cases, he may be made to believe he is drowning on the waterboard. "That's what this is," I told the Attorney General, holding the card aloft. "The details matter." I urged him to make sure that all of the principals on the National Security Council stared at those details while deciding our country's future interrogation policy. Gonzalez paused for a long time, as he often did. He then thanked me for coming to him with this and asked whether he could keep my card with the handwritten list so he could use it at the meeting. I handed it to him and left, praying that I'd made a difference. I heard nothing immediately after the Principals Committee meeting. Late in the afternoon, I attended a meeting on sentencing policy with the Attorney General and others. In front of the others, unprompted, the Attorney General told me the White House meeting had gone very well, and that he had told them just what I had asked, but all the principals were entirely supportive of the current interrogation policy and all parts of it. No policy changes were made. CIA-enhanced interrogations could continue. Human beings in the custody of the United States government would be subjected to harsh and horrible treatment. And I never got my card back. I left government service 2 months later. I was never going to return. Chapter 8, In Hoover's Shadow. The supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, whether it is on a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office. Dwight D. Eisenhower. On the first day of summer in 2013, I found myself where I'd never thought I'd be again. On the bright day when President Barack Obama announced my nomination in the Rose Garden to replace FBI Director Bob Mueller, the President, Mueller, and I stood alone in the Oval Office, waiting to walk out the glass door and into the garden, where the White House press pool already had gathered. As we turned to step into view of the cameras, the President stopped us. With a serious look on his face, Obama turned to me and said, "Jim, there's one thing I forgot to talk to you about." While I looked confused, the President nodded toward Mueller. "Bob long ago made a commitment to me, and I need you to honor it." What could this possibly be? The President had assured me of my independence. Now I was being asked for secret assurances? The President paused to signal the gravity of the moment. Then he went on. "Bob has always allowed me to use the FBI gym to play basketball, and I need you to commit to continuing that." I laughed. "Of course, Mr. President. It is your gym in a way." Though I love basketball, I knew I would never join him in the FBI gym. I also love golf, but knew we would never play. FBI directors can't be that way with presidents. Everybody knows why. Or at least I thought they did. After leaving the Bush Justice Department in August 2005, I worked in the private sector. With 5 kids approaching college at about 2-year intervals, and 15 years of government salary that hadn't exactly been conducive to saving, it was time to save some money. I went to work as the chief lawyer, general counsel, at the defense contractor Lockheed Martin for 5 years, and then at an investment firm called Bridgewater Associates in Connecticut for 3 years. In early 2013, I left Bridgewater and joined the faculty at Columbia Law School as a fellow focused on national security, because I've always found teaching deeply rewarding. That March, Attorney General Eric Holder called out of the blue to ask whether I would interview for FBI director. He wasn't guaranteeing me the job, but said he wouldn't be calling personally if I wasn't going to be very seriously considered. I was surprised. Maybe it was because I had become so hardened to the tribal loyalties of Washington, D.C., that it was difficult to believe a Democrat would choose someone who had been a political appointee of his Republican predecessor for such an important post. I also was on record as having financially contributed to President Obama's political opponents. I was cold to the idea. It would be too much for my family. I didn't tell him why I said that, but Patrice was in graduate school and working as a counselor at a walk-in mental health clinic in Bridgeport. One of our kids was a senior in high school, and we were foster parents with continuing connections and obligations to young people who had been in our home. Holder asked me to think about it. I told him I would sleep on it, but the answer was likely to be no. I woke up the next morning and Patrice was missing from our bedroom. I went downstairs and found her in the kitchen on her laptop. She was looking at houses for sale in the Washington, D.C. area. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I've known you since you were 19. This is who you are. This is what you love. So go down there and do your best." Then she paused and added, "But they're not going to pick you anyway." She liked President Obama and had voted for him, but she still thought this was just an exercise. Her interest, she later confessed, was in not having my sad face moping around for years afterward talking about what might have been. She, like me, doubted he'd pick someone who'd worked in the Bush administration. After preliminary interviews with his staff, I met President Obama in the Oval Office. He sat in the same position President Bush always had, in an armchair with his back to the fireplace, on the side closest to the grandfather clock. I sat on the couch to his left, on the cushion closest to him. We were joined by the White House counsel, Kathy Rumler, who sat across from me. I had never met President Obama before and was struck by 2 things. How much thinner he appeared in person, and his ability to focus. As Rumler and I stood just outside the Oval Office waiting for the meeting to begin, I could see the president standing at his desk holding the phone. Kathy said he was talking with the governor of Oklahoma about the historic tornadoes that had torn through that state, killing 2 dozen people and injuring hundreds. Obama hung up the phone, waved me into the room, spoke briefly about the terrible tragedy in Oklahoma, and then shifted entirely to the new subject, the FBI. The president was almost grave in explaining why he took the selection of the FBI director so seriously. In a way, this and the Supreme Court are the two most important personnel decisions a president makes, because I'm choosing for the future, he said. You will be here after I'm gone. He said he thought there was great value in that long tenure, and hoped that if I were the director, I could help a new president. For example, he said he had been pushed to make military decisions as a new, killing 24 people and injuring hundreds. Obama hung up the phone, waved me into the room, spoke briefly about the terrible tragedy in Oklahoma, and then shifted entirely to the new subject, the FBI. The president was almost grave in explaining why he took the selection of the FBI director so seriously. In a way, this and the Supreme Court are the two most important personnel decisions a president makes, because I'm choosing for the future, he said. You will be here after I'm gone. He said he thought there was great value in that long tenure, and hoped that if I were the director, I could help a new president. For example, he said he had been pushed to make military decisions as a new and inexperienced president, and under great pressure from military leaders. Without saying so, he seemed to be expressing regret that he didn't have the experienced counsel around him that he needed at the time. He thought it was good that I would be around to help a future, perhaps similarly inexperienced leader think about national security decisions better. We talked about the natural tension between the need to investigate leaks of classified information and the need to support a free press. Recent Department of Justice efforts to investigate leak cases were much in the news at that point, and the press was assailing the alleged Obama administration crackdown. We didn't talk about particular cases, but I shared my view that the balance could be struck by thoughtful leadership. It simply was not sustainable to say the investigators would never seek information from reporters, and it was an exaggeration to say that we couldn't have a free press if we investigated leaks. We could protect a free press and classified information at the same time. What surprised me most, and led me in the moment to realize Patrice was likely wrong about this being a waste of time, was the president's view of the FBI job. It turns out he had a different conception of the FBI director than either I or most partisans assumed. He said, "I don't want help from the FBI on policy. I need competence and independence. I need to sleep at night knowing the place is well run and the American people protected." Contrary to my assumption, the fact that I was politically independent from him might actually have worked in my favor. I replied that I saw it the same way. The FBI should be independent and totally divorced from politics, which is what the 10-year term for a director was designed to ensure. After my meeting with President Obama, I called Patrice with the wise-ass comment, "Your faith in their poor judgment may be misplaced." Feeling good about my conversation with Obama, I agreed to the nomination when it was offered. My family would stay in Connecticut for 2 years to wind up all the things they were involved in, but I fully intended to serve as director of the FBI through the year 2023. What, I wondered, could possibly interfere with that? After deciding I was his choice, but before he announced the nomination, President Obama surprised me by inviting me back to the Oval Office. We sat in the same seats and were again joined by the White House counsel. The president opened the conversation by explaining, "Once you are director, we won't be able to talk like this." What he meant was that, for over 40 years, the leaders of our government had understood that a president and an FBI director must be at arm's length. The FBI is often called upon to investigate cases that touch on the president's senior aides and affect the course of his presidency. To be credible, both in reality and in perception, the FBI and its director cannot be close with the president. So one final time, President Obama and I had the kind of conversation two college classmates might. We discussed and debated hard issues that were not under the FBI director's purview, like using drones to kill terrorists. I was struck by the way he could see and evaluate a variety of angles on a complicated issue, and I suppose he wanted to make one last assessment of me and the way I thought through problems before my nomination was a done deal. On my way out the door, I told Kathy Rumler how surprised I was by the interesting discussion, telling her, "I can't believe someone with such a supple mind actually got elected president." President Obama and I would never have another casual conversation. Before I took the job, the FBI had had only six directors since 1935, when it was officially named as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Its first, the legendary J. Edgar Hoover, had led the organization for nearly 50 years, including its predecessor organization, the Bureau of Investigation, and built a culture around himself that profoundly shaped the Bureau and its agents. For decades, Hoover used an iron